All righty. Okay, got the last leg here, guys, heading toward lunchtime. So we're jump into everybody's favorite step here, the fourth step. We'll talk about that a little bit. And, you know, one of the things that that we don't pay attention to a lot of times is, you know, there's promises just about on every step. You know, if you look at them closely, we know the ninth step promises. But there's a lot of positive promises, but there's also some negative promises in there. And one of them is right at the end of the third step, which says, you know, that basically the third step is once you've turned your will and life over to God, it will simply evaporate unless you immediately, at once, it says, jump into this next process called the inventory process. You know, and that's kind of the interesting part about all the steps, right, is that they're all chained together. And I think, as many of you know, if you've been around AA, this is some time where the whole thing breaks down, you know. All right, I'm powerless over alcohol. God, it's yours. I'm done. And as it says, no, you're not. In fact, that whole spiritual thing you just did in turning your will and life over pretty much is going to evaporate unless you now get down to work and take a look at this spiritual malady hidden deep down inside called the fourth step. And, you know, I don't know about you guys. I mean, there's a lot of fear around the fourth step, and I didn't really have a problem with that. You know, the eighth and ninth step, you know, became much more of a fearful thing for me. Of course, when you owe $250,000, that gets to be a little scary. I wasn't looking forward to dealing with that deal for sure. But, you know, one of the things about the fourth step that I was taught is that we write it down, you know. And I didn't like that at first, you know. One, I'm lazy. And two, I was like, you know, I can do it in my head. I can do it in my head. I mean, I think about that stuff all the time. I'll be willing to talk to you about it. And they said, no, you write it down. And, you know, I don't know what that's about. I still don't know how that works exactly, but there's a power in that, you know, that I found initially, and I still find it. You know, when I have to bring it out of my head through my arm onto a piece of paper, somehow it just gets to be more honest. You know, it's like in the whole process with my prayer life was kind of the same thing. You know, I prayed. You know, I prayed. In fact, when I was living in that basement before I got sober, there was a Catholic church on my way to my office. And here I'm living in a basement. I've lost everything again. And once in a while, I'd stop in. They'd have 7 o'clock mass there in the morning at that church, and I'd stop in. And I'd get in the back of the church, and I'd kneel back there, and I'd have my suit on and stuff. And there'd be all these old people up there, right, at 7 a.m., just me and the old people. And I remember saying to God, God, look at this. There's all these old people in here and me. Look, I'm here too. I should get something for this, right? I don't need to be here. I'm not ready to die. Those old people are, but I'm here. But my prayer was this. You know, I don't know what my prayer was, but the interpretation of my prayer was, God, give me the power today to go out and get out of the hole. All right? Give me the power, God, so I can go out today and find a way out of this hole I'm in. See, I always was asking for the power. And then when I came into AA, even, my prayer life was between me and God, you understand. And they said, Tim, the problem with that, but if the communication is between you and God, guess what? We got a sick person on the end of the line on one of the ends. And that happens to be you. Because my prayer was, all right, God, my prayer is, do you think I should hit on that girl in my meeting this morning? And God said, yes, of course he said yes. Now, the interesting part was, you guys suggested, how about putting somebody between you and God, you know, to kind of filter your prayer? And that was my sponsor and other people. And you know what? It's an entirely different deal when you do that. You know, when that God's answer comes back through another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it never comes out exactly the way I hear it. And see, I'm going back to the same thing, because the fourth step is the first time that it says to us right after three is that now you've got this great relationship with the power greater than yourself, or you've admitted that you have one. And now we're immediately going to say it's worthless. It's worthless unless you put some human beings in the mix. And isn't this the first time that we learn the process? We're going to ask God's help, but now we're going to have to share that with another human being. You know, and not only will that be the first time we do it, it's going to come back down the road in 10 and say that's the deal every day. You know, each day we'll face anger, fear, dishonesty, resentment. And what's the deal? We immediately ask God's help. We share immediately with another human being. We clean up our side of the street, and then we resolutely turn our attentions to helping somebody else. You know, that's the whole process that they tell us in 10. But this is the first time in my life when I get to step 4 that you're going to ask me to share all this stuff with somebody other than me and my God, you know. And I want to tell you, my life started to change when my, you know, prayer, so to speak, with God got filtered by you guys. You know, and the thing about the 4-step too is that, you know, this whole business of being willing, you know, to share my life and everything that goes with it, especially the dark side, with another human being was just something that, you know, I had never done. You know, if you were Catholic again, you know, we had confession, you know, you went to the priest, you know, behind a cloth so he couldn't see who you were, and you told him about half about what he needed to know, you know. And here you're going to ask me to not only go face to face with another man, but to thoroughly, you know, go down in there and rake up everything and tell him everything. And, you know, as I said last night, you know, I had lived my whole life and the truth simply couldn't be good enough in my life. And this was the first time you said, well, if you're going to stay sober, the truth has to be good enough in your life. And the first thing is you have to find out what it is. You know, I heard a guy saying it was me. You know, half the stuff that I was so mad about, I came to find out never even happened. You know, I mean, I had lied about stuff for so long, I found out that wasn't even true. You know, I had created my own world, you know, as we do. And this was designed to say, no, Tim, let's find out what the real truth is in every aspect of your life. And if you can get down to that core position, then you have a chance, you know, to start building this new life that you'd like. And we were talking about it. Of course, you know, I'm old school on this. I mean, I know there's all kind of sheets out there. I mean, all the treatment centers around us have these, you know, elaborate sheets that you do the four step with name. And then they have 70 boxes across here in terms of what it affects, which I always find is interesting because, you know, the guys I do the thing with, they'll have, you know, I'm mad at Joel because he stole my wife and it affects my self-esteem and it affects my, you know, financial security. It affects my, I'm like, well, of course it does. I mean, you know, they got all of them checked. You know, very rarely, you know, do I see any of them that didn't check some negative thing that it affected in their life. And, you know, the first couple things I wanted to mention is the necessity of writing it down. And, you know, and the thing I learned is that there's no perfect way to do it. You know, and I tell guys, I was taught the old way, at the four-column way, right out of the big book, legal pad, you know, so that's still used, you know. The basic deal became is, are you willing, after you get it on paper, to sit down, you know, in the fifth step, you know, and share not only what's on the paper, but what goes along with it. You know, we were talking about, you know, first anger, you know, fear, dishonesty, and resentment, and our book basically talks about resentment, you know, as being the number one offender. And no doubt it's not a good thing, you know. But in all honesty, what I'd have to tell you, I mean, obviously I've had some issues with that, and I work on it, but actually fear, you know, for me has been the overriding part of my life that just absolutely has been something I've had to work with constantly. You know, and I guess the thing, you know, with resentment is, you know, and this is the whole idea that we're talking about before of being willing to go in there and admit for the first time that there's something bad wrong down here. There's something down deep inside of me that nobody, I mean, you heard me last night. I went to psychiatrists. I went to psychologists. I went to marriage counselors. I mean, you know, we were trying to find out what was wrong with little Timmy for a long, long time, you know. But the deal was, until little Timmy went down in there and found out where this hole in his soul was, you know, nothing was going to happen. So, I mean, if you haven't done a fourth or you're getting ready to do it, you know, don't be afraid. You know, it's the neatest thing to get down in there and to find out who this rusty old dog is that's been dragging your butt around for so long, you know. And we were just talking at the break. I don't know about you guys, but that's just been an evolving situation with me. I just continue, as the 10th step says, to get more insight and effectiveness about what makes me tick and who I am. And, you know, I'm not afraid anymore of the dark side. You know, I mean, I guess what I wanted you all to believe, I wanted to run from my dark side. I wanted it to go away. And, in the fourth and fifth step, what I know today, were not about that at all. You know, they simply was about getting in touch with it. It was simply about getting, you know, involved with it, getting it on paper so I could see it. And then we were going to talk about six and seven, and we'll talk about that later on, about, you know, having God take away this stuff. I had no more, you know, ability to get rid of that stuff, and I had to stop drinking. You know, that was going to be God's deal, not mine. So I had the whole wrong idea is that when I did four and five, I was going to identify this stuff, and then I had the burden of changing it all. And they said, no, Tim, you don't have the burden of doing anything except, you know, as best to your ability, getting honest, getting it on paper, and being willing to share that with another human being. You know, it's about, again, doing the actions. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I continued to be fear-based. You know, I don't know about you guys. I did my four-step in my head the way before I did it on my paper because I wanted to do it so right, you understand. I wanted to do it perfectly. I wanted to have a four-step better than anybody had ever done one in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, that's the insanity of my mind. And they're saying, Tim, just do it, son. You know, well, when? I don't know if I'm ready. Well, how would you know if you're ready? You know, sit down, put it on paper. I don't care if you end up with one page. I don't care if you end up with 40 pages. You know, let's get into action. You know, the resentment thing, you know, I guess I would have told you when I showed up that I don't know what fueled my alcoholism. I do know this, you know, when I drink, you know, it was kind of like the Incredible Hulk. I used to tell that story because I related to that a lot. You remember that story, the Incredible Hulk? There was this guy that was Dr. David Banner, right? He was this good guy. You know, in fact, he was a hell of a guy. He would go town to town. He moved around quite a bit for some reason, but he'd go town to town and he'd find somebody to help in that town and, you know, just a good guy. I really identified with him, but man, I tell you, sooner or later, somebody would do something, right, that this guy didn't like. And you talk about irritable, restless, and discontent. I mean, he turned into this thing called the Hulk, and he would tear up everything and everybody around him. You know, you remember this? And he'd wake up the next day and look around, and everything was torn up, and he'd be all guilt, shame, and remorse. And then he'd pack his bag and go on to the next town, and next week he'd do the same damn thing again. You know, I thought, man, that's the story of my life right there. I wanted to be Dr. David Banner. You know, I didn't want to get thrown out of every restaurant in Louisville for fighting. But, you know, I didn't understand when ethyl alcohol went into my body and the inhibitions, the only ones I had were down, whatever was there, man, came out. And what was there was a lot of rage. There was a lot of rage and a lot of anger. I mentioned this briefly last night. You know, my dad went to prison when I was 10. And it was, I would have told you that was something that, you know, hey, just happened, no big deal. Because when it happened, I was the oldest of seven kids, and it was a huge deal in Louisville because it was a front page, white collar type of thing. I mean, hell, nowadays it wouldn't even probably make the paper with everything that's going on. But in those days, it was a fraud deal, and his picture was on the paper. There was five guys that were indicted. One of the guys killed himself during the trial. You know, and my dad went to prison, and I had to take over as the head of the household, a 10-year-old kid. And I would have told you, hey, that's what I was supposed to do and whatnot. I'm going to tell you, when I did my fourth step, I can't tell you how angry I was. I was angry because I was put in a position when I was 10 years old that I didn't like. I was put in a position that I had to live with for a long, long time. And I didn't know who to hate about it, you know. I tell you how it permeated in my life, though. You know, I grew up in the south end of Louisville, which is kind of the poor end of town. And my dad, when he had that trial, was represented by lawyers. Okay, I didn't know who they were. And all I heard is what an awful job they did and how they didn't care about him, and he ended up going to prison. That was it. I'm 10 years old. Lawyers are out as a group. My mother was a doctor. I mean, she was a nurse. And she worked in surgery with nurses, and she had to go through something when I was about 13, where she had to defend some of these surgeons who were lying, and she had to go to court, you know, and she really upset her, and she had almost a nervous breakdown over it. Doctors, out. Out. Now, here's what I don't know. I have eliminated two whole segments of society, doctors and lawyers, and the whole East End of Louisville. Now, again, I don't know that cognizantly, you know, but I even showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you tell you how God works. I've had two sponsors since I've been in AA. One's a doctor and one's a lawyer. God works just very efficiently, I find out. But this whole thing about hating the other end of town, I wouldn't go to a meeting on that end of town. And I would tell you, well, I just don't like meetings on that end of town. I want to stay down here with my own people. And the truth was, I'll tell you a great story. This is how I was. I was asked to speak out in that end of town. And I took some of my guys from the halfway house, and we drove out there that day, and I pull in the parking lot, and there's Jaguars, and there's Mercedes parked in there, and I'm like, uh-huh, they're here. They are here. It's them, whatever that meant, right? And I go to give my talk, and I can't really think straight because I'm not in AA. I'm in the enemy's spot. You know, I mean, that's deep down inside me. A bunch of people from my home group had come out to listen to me talk, and they were sitting right in the front row. About halfway through my talk, this guy gets up in the middle, and there's probably 300-400 people there, and he gets up and leaves, all right? And I knew who he was. He was a guy who drove the Jaguar. And I want to tell you, when I saw that guy, I lost total focus on everything. All I saw was that son of a bitch in the Jaguar just walked out on my talk. And from that point forward, I mean, I was an idiot. I don't know what I said the rest of the way. I was shaking on the inside. And, you know, I went home that night and just cried. I said, what happened there? What happened there? Interesting thing, I went back to my home group the following week, and the three people from my home group, there were women who came out to say that I was telling them about this. And they go, hey, Tim, that's great. Hey, did you think that we drove all the way across town just to sit there and hear you? What about us? See, what about us? What about the rest of the people in the room? See, and I had the ability. And what I realized was, see, that went back. I can trace that. That goes right back to my old man. That goes right back to that bad deal I thought he got on the lawyers. You know? And I got in fights over that, because when that happened, my brother and I, who's also sober, we talked about this one time, and we were in fist fights on a daily basis for kids teasing us about, you know, my old man being a con. You know, and you grew up with that, and it became part of who you were. And I say that because that's one thing in my fourth step that popped up. And I cried about it. I screamed about it, you know, and it was the beginning of me getting some real healing with my dad. Okay. And I'll talk about that a little while because he and I did not have a good relationship, and some insight finally about something that was driving me, something that was fueling that rage in me for many, many years. And I'm much better at it today. You know, I still have my preferences where I like to go to meetings and where I don't. But I've got freedom today. I don't have to hate every doctor. I don't have to hate every lawyer. You know, I have some insight that it came to me. And it came to me and started in the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the next category about fear. We were just talking about this. You know, I have been a fear-ridden kid or person my whole life. You know, I don't know. I was thinking about this. This is embarrassing to even. I was thinking about, you know, was in the John there earlier. And when I was a kid, about third grade, I had this phobia about going to the bathroom, you know, at school, you know, because you always, you know, one time it happened where I was taking a crap and a bunch of the kids jumped up on the top of the thing and looked down at me. And that became a fear of mine, I mean, forever. I mean, I would do anything not to go to the bathroom outside of home. And that's very difficult to do, especially if you travel a whole lot, you know. But it was real. It was a fear. It was no basis to it. But, I mean, I had to, when I did my fourth step, I was like, oh, I hate to admit this one. You're not going to believe this. And I laid it out, and he said, why am I not going to believe it? Is it a real fear? I said, yes, sir, I've had it. I had it to the extent that my mom had to go to the teacher, and I had a special time to go to the bathroom all by myself, right? I mean, and the point being is, I mean, what consequence is to that? Well, the consequence is that I had to get in touch with the components of this fear knot that somehow has existed in my gut, you know, forever and ever. You know, and that started in the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I say to you is that I thought you were only supposed to put things down there that made sense. I thought you were only supposed to put things down there that if it was no longer a problem, you certainly didn't need to put it down there, did you? Or if it seemed trivial, you don't need to put it down there, do you? And it says, no, yes, you do. It says thorough for a reason. You know, there's some, you'll never know, Tim, what the components of all this might be as it comes out on paper. You know, the fear thing, though, we were talking about this, and I've had to come to grips with this, probably fear more than resentment, has just impacted my life, especially in sobriety. You know, we're telling that story I told earlier about, you know, just riding to work on Monday morning, you know, and for no particular reason, you know, that fear just, you know, it's like I used to go to a meeting on Saturday morning when I first got sober, and it was just a great meeting, man. I'd leave all fired up. I'd get in my car to start driving home back to my place, and I'd just start crying. You know, I was just almost paralyzed. And what I learned about fear and anger is that they're both normal emotions. Got to have them, right? You know, if you don't have a fear of crossing the street in the traffic, you're going to get run over and killed. That's a healthy fear. You know, even anger is a normal emotion, okay? But frozen fear and frozen anger were my problems. And the steps were going to be designed to break up the ice. Because see, if I let the fear freeze, if I let it stay sit up in me, then it really can become damaging, not only to me, but there's a lot of collateral damage around me. This step, the fourth step, was the first way in saying, no, Tim, don't let it sit there. You know, don't let the fear sit there. Acknowledge it. You know, and even today, you know, we were talking about this at the break. You know, I just have to work at that constantly. I don't question where it comes from anymore. I don't question why it's there. You know, my job is just to acknowledge that it's there. And that's all we're doing in the steps. You know, I mean, a lot of times when you do fourth and fifth steps with a guy, I've had guys that they want to analyze their fourth step. Let me explain this to you. All right. Let me explain this to you before I even tell you what it is. And I said, no. You're not supposed to analyze it, interpret it. You're just supposed to write it down as you know it. Just throw it out there on the table. That's all we're asked to do. And trust that, you know, God will work it and take it from there. And that's real hard to do, you know, sometimes with these things. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about was the, since we're an all-men's group, we can do that, is the sex inventory. You know, two things about that. Obviously, it's important enough that they gave it its own column, you know. So Wilson obviously knew that, you know, that instinct, the sexual instinct is such that it causes us problems. And obviously, if you listen to our stories, I mean, it does cause us problems. And, you know, the significance of it is for me is I think in many ways we get too crazy about it. We overstate it. And I think somewhat Wilson was trying to say when he said, you know, everybody has their own flavor a little bit. You know, some think it's too much. Some think there's not enough. That's not the issue here. The issue with the sexual inventory was really, for me, was honesty and selfishness. Okay, because again, as I looked at the sexual inventory, what really were the issues that were pertinent to me was the dishonesty involved in my sex relations and the selfishness, certainly, in my sex relations. You know, I share this, and this is going to be on tape. Maybe. Okay. That's okay, too. I can usually only share it in men's groups, but I never share it otherwise. But it is the truth, because one of the things I learned about is obviously, especially in my early sobriety, all right, I'm not going to drink, but I got a lot of urges, you understand, and I got a lot of things that are driving me. And one of them is my sex drive, and what are you supposed to do with that? You know, I show up in AA, and you say, you know, no relationships for a year, and you know, this doesn't seem right. And I remember going back to my early sobriety, and, you know, and what I found out was there was a correlation, you know, between a lot of things. For example, sweets. You know, there's a direct correlation between sweets and sex. I mean, a lot of the same chemical processes that go on in sex are the same thing that happen when we drink, and the same thing that happen when you eat sweets. You know, that's why in the early days, you know, the old guys gave you what, honey and, you know, chocolate and stuff to cure that urge. And I was telling somebody one time, I really understood that, because when I first got sober and I was single and celibate at the time, as I was most of the time, I finally got out of that basement and I got an apartment and I was living in that apartment. I went to this meeting one night and, man, I was eating chocolate like you can't believe, you know, I mean, I'm eating buckets of chocolate every day and I'm feeling a little guilty about it. And we're in a meeting, and this lady, she must have been 300 pounds. And it came around, and they were talking about this chocolate. And I said, you know, boy, I don't know. I might be overdoing that chocolate thing. I'm gouging that stuff. And she said, well, honey, that's okay. You know, it says in the big book, you know, that you can eat all the sweets you want. And I said, well, thank you. That's a good thing. I said, it really made me. And then I was hearing him talking about how so much like sex is so much like drinking, and that it affects the same types of chromosomes and whatnot. Because what I need to tell you was, you know, my early sobriety, I got in this apartment. And my program, this was kind of my program for like the first 6 months of my sobriety. You know, I'd go to work, I'd come home, I'd go to my meeting. I'd come home, you know, say my prayers, eat a Snickers bar, jack off, and go to bed. That was my program. That was pretty much it. God said to me one time, man, are you still doing that? I said, oh, hell no, I haven't had a Snickers bar in a long time. But, you know, I say that because, you know, one of the things I realized was that, relief. It was all about relief, right? I mean, I haven't pulled no bones about it. You know, I was one of those guys that when I was a kid, I mean, alcohol actually worked for me before I ever tasted it. Because I want to tell you about my dad. My dad was one of these guys, you talk about restless, irritable, and discontent, right? And if he didn't stop at the tavern before he got home, you know, we'd all be sitting there at the table waiting for him. And if he hadn't had a drink, boy, you'd walk in and you'd see that face and he was just like this. But then I'd watch him and he'd reach up in that cabin, he'd get that Yellowstone whiskey and he'd pop him a shot of that. And he'd take a beer and he'd knock that thing back and go, guck, 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 all at one time and his head would go down and go, and I'd be sitting there going, man, that felt good. You know, I remember watching his face going, I don't know what just went on there, but I am in to that, okay? I mean, I'm 10 years old. I haven't tasted alcohol, but that made me feel good. I had the same need that he did, you know. I mean, I can tell you that today. And so it's the same thing. You know, I understood, you know, with sex or with a chocolate bar, you know, it was all about relief. It was all about... What I found the first time I drank it, it made my world just right. It changed a world that was out of focus and brought it into clarity. In fact, it went from black and white to color, you know, very quickly when I drank alcohol. I don't know about you guys, but that's what it did for me. And an interesting part, it didn't continue that way, but my first experience never left me. And I chased that going from black and white to color the rest of my life. So I say that because, see, what I need to understand about sex is that I can use that, and I will use that the very same way that I used alcohol. And, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, I have, you know, been in this thing over 20 years, and I can honestly say is that I certainly saw it as an alternative, you know, to drinking, as many of us do. And that's why these issues came into play, and one of them was, I said to my sponsor earlier on, I said, well, man, the big book doesn't make a judgment on that. It says, you know, whatever. It says more sex for some, less sex for others. And he said, yeah, it does say that, Tim, but it also says something about dishonesty and selfishness, doesn't it? Look at all of your sexual relationships and all of your relationships with the opposite sex in terms of selfishness and dishonesty. Ugh. Now, when it came down to that, there's where the issue lied. You know, and I don't know about you guys. I mean, we've got guys in AA that are supposedly, you know, spiritual giants, you know, 25 and 30 years sober, you know, hitting on every female newcomer that comes in the door. Now, again, you know, if it's just about sex and finding relief, I guess you make your own call on that. But I want to tell you what, if it's about harm to others, if it's about honesty in your life, you know, then it's a whole different question. You know, and that's what I always drive to with all the guys that I work with. You know, I'm not going to make a call on, you know, any of your sexual behavior, but let's talk about, is there harm to others involved? No, man, it was consensual. You know, she was in it as much as I was. And I said, you know what, that's very rare that happens. You know, sex is an intimate thing. And most of the time, whether we like to admit it or not, there is an innate harm that's set up almost every time. And what about dishonesty? You are married. Well, yeah, but, you know, what's that got to do with it? What's got everything to do with it? And was there selfishness involved? You know, and again, so what I'm saying is that, you know, the thing I would say about the sexual inventory, I think one of the reasons that Wilson somehow knew, and many of you know his story, I mean, he was driven and had a lot of problems in that whole area of his life, you know, like any human being does, normal man. And I think that's one of the reasons that it ended up there. And so, again, I think it's important to me to this extent is that, you know, it's just like everything else in my life. You know, if my sobriety is going to hinge on, you know, the truth in my life, then coming to grips with what that is about my sexual life becomes very, very important, you know. And you know, the other thing, too, and I alluded to this last night, is that, you know, this whole thing about selfishness and self-centeredness, I just continue to be amazed, you know, about the manifestations of that in my life. You know, and it's sometimes it's almost embarrassing. And we were talking about that, where they show up in. You know, we were talking about earlier about the things you come to learn about yourself as time goes on that keeps your life so unmanageable. And I was telling them, you know, so I travel a lot if I'm taking a long car trip. And my wife will be going, man, there's something in me, you know, I just like to go fast. You know, and... You know, and I'm never comfortable going fast, right? I'm going 90 and 70, and I'm looking left, I'm looking right, I'm checking my mirror all the time, and I'm just wearing myself out. And I'm saying to my wife, you know, gosh, this driving just wears me out. She'll say, Tim, why don't you go 70 and see how that works? You know, why don't you follow the law? And that would take maybe some of the stress away from this. Or how about this one? She caught me. We were on a vacation. I was telling these guys not too long ago, and I'll be driving, and all of a sudden I find myself in competition. All right, there's a guy that's been kind of going with me for the last 25, 30 miles. He's behind me. Everything's good. But all of a sudden, he comes left, and he gets by me. Now, I never say anything. My wife will point this out to me, but she knows I'm going to catch him. I'm going to catch them. You know, I mean, there's something about people going by me that still bothers me. You know, I mean, it's insanity. It's insanity, you know, but you get in touch with this. And, you know, and I'm saying that the peace in my life today that's come from the step into inventory, you know, the book says very clearly our problems are of our own making. Yeah, go 70 instead of 90 and see how that feels. Follow the rules, Tim, and see how that feels. Oh, it's so comfortable. I don't have to worry about the police catching me. And it's sometimes as we go on and we get these insights about it, you know, our life, you know, takes on, or at least mine has, you know, a whole different meaning. Just talking about the process of the fourth and fifth step too, you know, obviously, I think it's a privilege, you know, to be able to participate in that process and be able to listen to someone's fifth step. And it's a responsibility, huge responsibility. And, you know, like everything else in my program, in my life, I've had to learn the hard way and get burnt and get embarrassed to do this right. And early in my sobriety, I had a guy, and it wasn't necessarily a fifth step. There was a guy that I was working with, and he shared in confidence with me about something. And it was funny, you know, you know, how sometimes newcomers thinking is about things. And you know, I thought in a harmless way, I shared what he had shared with me with some other guys, you know, that kind of hung out in our group. And, sure enough, you know, he came to me and said, Tim, you know, I understand that you shared what I shared with you with these other guys. And I was like, yeah, you know, I didn't see any problem. And he said, well, I'm going to get a new sponsor. Whew. And it was a great lesson to me, you know, because as harmless as I thought what it was, is that what I had realized that I had violated this very basic, you know, very privileged responsibility that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous to listen, you know, to other people's lives. You know, and I tell you what, I take it very seriously today, you know, and to sit with somebody in their fifth step and understand the responsibility to keep that, you know, confidential in every way. And I don't know about you all, if you've experienced that, you know, and the otherwise. I've been on the other end of that, you know. I've been on the other end of that with a guy that I worked with early on who was my first sponsor and found out that some things had, you know, come out of those conversations that had gotten to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it is a very, very privileged thing, and I encourage everybody, you know, to take it seriously. You know, so kind of summing up kind of where we got to, you know, as we head toward lunch is that, you know, we're going to get talk this afternoon about 6 and 7 and 7 and 8. And then what I was going to do in the morning, hopefully, is talk about the maintenance steps, 9, 10, and 11, and maybe a little bit about the traditions. And I really look forward to talking to some of you too this afternoon, one-on-one, about, you know, some of these things. And, you know, so, you know, to this point in time, at least for me, you know, and as good as it got for me going through steps 4 and 5, to be real honest with you, where I had gotten to was, all right, I'm powerless over alcohol, I'm not the power, and here's the, I'm willing to turn my will and life over, and here's the garbage as I can see it, you know. And, you know, that was 19 years ago, or a little over 18 and a half years ago. And what I can tell you from that point forward, you know, God's kind of gradually taken over, and as long as I've stayed willing, you know, to honor that process and stay in what I call the loop of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, insight and effectiveness has come my way. You know, I don't know about you guys. When I look at the first 4 step I did, you know, it was the best I could do, you know, for where I was at the time. But, you know, now looking back on it, you know, it was like it didn't even scratch the surface. But see, I think that's the whole idea behind the steps. You know, we only scratch the surface when we start off, and then we're given a process of daily living in 10 and 11 and 12. That we grow in insight and effectiveness. As God brings life to us, then we apply these very same principles that we found in the first 5 steps, you know, and we start, you know, doing the same thing in our lives. And my life is all about that today. And one of the things we're going to talk about, you know, in the maintenance steps is balance in your life. You know, I was telling some of these guys, in early in my sobriety, I had a real issue with the balance in my life. Meaning I couldn't seem to find enough time for AA and my personal life and my business life. In fact, they were all in conflict with one another, you know. And I remember asking everybody, how do you make the decisions to keep all those things in balance? And of course the answer was, well, you don't, Tim. Because here's the implied thing. Tim, if you could balance your life, that assumes that you could manage your life, doesn't it? You can no more balance your life than you can manage it. God will do the balancing. You only have one directive. Practice these principles. Carry the message to another alcoholic and practice these principles in all your affairs. You know, what I can need to tell you, and I'll talk about this more tomorrow, is I don't know how this works, but that's exactly right. You know, Chuck Chamberlain said, you know, we take care of God's kids and God will take care of us. And somewhere along the line, when I adapted that, you know, there's really today no division in my life. They're kind of all lapped together. My personal life, my business life, my AA life. You know, they aren't separate anymore. Somewhere along the line, as you promised, they all came into harmony. And here's the thing I'll never understand. What I can honestly tell you right now is I obviously spent more time in Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery activities than I ever have. I spend more quality time in my business than I ever have. And by far, I spend more quality time in my personal life than I ever have. Now, how does that work? I don't know. I don't know. I just know that that's where I'm at today. And I go back to when I was 5 years sober, trying to balance all those things and how much time. You know, and the promise was, Tim, if you stay on the firing line and you keep God's kids first, and Alcoholics Anonymous, and you find a way to help them, as Chuck Chamberlain said, God will take care of the rest of it. You know, and it really has been the case in my life. Sometimes I'm bewildered by that. And I love my life today because there is no separation anymore. You know, somehow it just seems to work exactly as it needs to work. And so what we'll do here, we'll finish up. We've got through 5, and again, this afternoon, I think what we're scheduled to do is go for about an hour, talk about 6 and 7, and then we'll see where we go. If we get through with the steps earlier today, then we'll talk about the traditions a little bit tomorrow. But I just want to, you know, I feel really self-conscious about this sometimes. You know, you're up here talking to a bunch of people. I don't know anything different about any of this stuff. You know, I can only tell you that you know, like I said, I used to call it the mumble jumble of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, like the old timers, you know, I heard a guy say one time, you need less and less in faith as you go on because you've got more and more experience. And isn't that what being an old timer is all about? You know, they know it's going to work out. They've been there, done that. Don't know how, don't know when, but it'll be okay. And that's the deal I want to say to you today. If you stay on the journey, do you have to have faith early on? Yeah. But as you stay around here, you need less and less faith because you've been here, you've seen it. You know, it was a bump in the road. I remember one time when I was going through that divorce, 9 years sober, a little while back. It was so awful, and I went to my sponsor, and he's got this real southern accent. He said, "Oh, Timmy, it's just a bump in the road, son." I'm thinking, bump in the road, my butt, you know. My life is caving in, you idiot. But you know what? I can look back and tell you it was a bump in the road. But I somehow knew when he said that he was right. It didn't feel like that. But I knew he was right because you know what? He had been through the same situation that I was going through then. And it had become a bump in the road for him. So anyway, it's about lunchtime. I love you guys and really thank you for having me do this. It's a real pleasure. Thanks.